What I like to look at is a scene that we're very familiar with. Parsha Vayera, of course, like all the Parshiot in Bereshit, is just filled with so many good things to talk about. Clearly, the Akedah. Last year, we talked about the whole issue of Sodom from the perspective of the what was it that the people of Sodom were demanding, and sort of a new approach. But today, I want to kind of rely on some of the older approaches that we have, but to take a different view of the whole story. Now, there's an important mental obstacle that we all have in studying Tanakh, and that is the division of chapters. Because ever since it was introduced by the Christians in the 13th century, after the printing press in the 15th century, we've all been kind of stuck with the chapter divisions. And we sort of naturally incline towards looking at each chapter as being a unit, which is sometimes accurate and sometimes really way off. Sometimes the unit starts in the middle of a chapter, or it goes into the next chapter. A classic example is, of course, the first story of creation, which starts with the beginning of Bereshit but ends in Vayichulu, which is already Perek Bet. And it leads to all sorts of weird anomalies. As an example, Shir HaShirim, which is probably the most murdered text when it comes to chapters, the division just stops at weird places. People read Shir HaShirim publicly. When they get to the end of a chapter, they do some sort of a tune, like they're finished with something in the middle of an idea. That's bizarre. Another thing is, for instance, I've been asked to do a podcast series on different books in Tanakh, and they want exactly a chapter a day. They know each podcast a chapter. And sometimes it just doesn't make sense to stop there. It's in the middle of something. But, you know, you can do what you got to do. The reason I'm mentioning that is because Perek Yud Chet of Bereshit is 2.5 scenes. Perek Yud Tet is 2.5 scenes. Perek Yud Chet is 2.5 scenes. It's a scene that starts at Avraham's tent, very famous. It ends with Avraham in Tfilah and negotiating for Sodom. And there's a half a scene in the middle, which is sort of the bridge between the two. And Perek Yud Tet starts out in Sodom with the whole event in Sodom. It ends in a scene in a cave somewhere in West Virginia, probably. And then... that's a little incest joke. And in the middle, there's also a bridge. So we look at it, we say, well, Perek Yud Chet's one thing, Perek Yud Tet's another thing. But that's when we come back to Masorah. When you open up a Sefer Torah, take a look at a Sefer Torah, and you will see that Perek Yud Chet and Perek Yud Tet, as we're calling them, are all one story. What tells us they're one story?
Parsha.
They're one Parsha. So when you open up a Sefer Torah, you see Vayera, you're looking for the next break, which, by the way, is the Baal Kriya, is critical. The hardest parshiot to read, all other things being equal, are parshiot that don't have breaks. Siddharim that don't have breaks. Because when you have breaks, like in Mishpatim, when every couple of psukim is a break, it's kind of easy, and if you get lost, you found yourself and you move on. Parsha Vayetzeh, the whole thing is one parsha. Very easy to get lost in there. If you're not really, you haven't really mastered the Kriya. And so, this first part of Vayera, from the beginning of Vayera until the very last scene in Perek Yud Tet, all five scenes, or six scenes, whatever you want to call them, are all one story. And so we step back and remove yourself from the orientation of chapter divisions. Got to wonder, well, why are these things together? But then you got to wonder something else. You take a look at the opening scene. It's an opening scene that we all know, which is Avram sitting at the tent, and the guys come to the tent, and he feeds them, and then they say, "We're Sarah," and etc. You got to wonder, what is the purpose of that entire scene? After all, back at the last part in Vadlech Lecha, Hashem came to Avram. He changes them to Avraham. And then he said, "He's a big bracha, you're going to have kings." And then he said, "Don't call Sarai Sarai anymore. Her name is Sarah, and she's going to have a kid." And Avram laughs, and he says, "You're going to call him, don't worry about Ishmael, but you're going to call this one Yitzchak. He'll be the real kid," which means this entire scene has already happened. And the only thing that's absent from it is Sarah's laughter, which for the most part we disregard. That's not the issue. He's already been told to call him Yitzchak because of Avram's laughter, which we interpret as being mirth and not ridicule. Right, as opposed to SARS. Okay, so the entire scene is bizarre. The entire interaction between Avraham, the negotiation that Avraham enters into, is a little bit strange also. What is it that Avraham's asking for? Hashem has somehow notified Avraham that he's going to destroy Sodom. But not exactly he's going to destroy Sodom. He's going to check Sodom out. And then, if he doesn't find what he's looking for, he's going to destroy Sodom. What's he looking for? We don't know. What's Avram's negotiating tactic? How does he start? He starts by saying, you are me Elohim Mishpat. You're the God of justice. And it's a lack of justice if you destroy the wicked with the innocent. And Tzadikim there means innocent, right? Like it does throughout Tanakh. So he starts off with this kind of strange number saying, okay, what if we find 50 Tzadikim? Right? 50 people are innocent of whatever it is someone's guilty of. Hashem says, okay, I'll let him go. I said, well, what if we're missing five? For five, you're going to... It's a smart negotiating tactic. He doesn't say, what if there's 45? He said, because of five, are you going to make... Okay, good, 45. Good, 40, 30, 20, 10. Why does Avram stop at 10? Because after all, the principle is the same. He should say, what if there's one tzaddik? After all, you can't kill a tzaddik. It's the lack of justice. So he's saying, if you find 10 tzaddikim, you won't destroy the city. But if you find 8 tzaddikim or 6 tzaddikim, you'll destroy the city. And you're going to have 6 or 8 people who died without justice. So the whole story is kind of bizarre. There's a lot of bizarre things in this story. We'll go over it. But at the end, and by the way, in the whole interaction with Sodom, what should happen based on Avram's negotiations when the two guys go into Sodom? What should they do? They should do a house-to-house search for tzaddikim. Right? Do like Yechezkel, put marks on the door. It's like this, and count how many marks you got. Instead, what do they do? What do these two guys do? They walk out of town, they go into the central plaza, Rehov Ha'ir, and they wait. What do they wait for? What are they waiting for? They're waiting for hospitality. And they're taken in. And then the result of whatever it is that happens is the city's destroyed. If the city's destroyed based on what we saw previously, in the previous negotiation, that should prove that there were not even 10 tzaddikim in the city. What does one have to do with the other? In other words, why don't they do a lottery, or why don't they do some sort of, have a public shiur, 70 guys show up, right? Yeah, less than 10, okay, destroy the city. It's a whatever it is. But this doesn't seem to have proven anything. And how many tzaddikim in the end did they find there? That's not clear at all. We know it's less than 10.
Also, was there a model beforehand?
For what?
Hospitality.
Is there a model for hospitality? I'm not sure why they need a model.
Meaning that God's going in there to check it out.
Yeah.
That's the test. But where does it come from? It's not like there's something happened beforehand.
No, I mean, hospitality is an ancient practice, especially among nomadic people, going way back before this time. So hospitality is a given. If it is a given, and maybe that's the question, but why would that be the litmus test? It's very strange. This whole thing is bizarre.
You often have a guest on the boat.
What? Say it again?
You often have a guest.
He had a ton of guests, by a bunch of quadrupeds and all, et cetera. What?
They didn't pay a fare.
How do you know? No. We don't know what they paid. At the end, at that really weird scene, which, by the way, I will ask, why do we need that scene?
Which
the scene with Lot, his daughters, in a cave in West Virginia with a bottle of Ripple.
But isn't
what is that scene about? But there's another question. Is in that scene, what does the elder girl say to her sister before starting it? She says the following words, Avinu Zaken, V'ish ein ba'aretz tavo aleinu k'derech kol ha'aretz. All right, Avinu Zaken, V'ish ein ba'aretz tavo aleinu k'derech kol ha'aretz. So it is her impression, whether she really thinks this or she's putting on a smokescreen, is that everybody's dead because they've seen this terrible destruction. And now we're going to have to repopulate the earth. So the only way to do it is with Father. Evidently, Father won't agree to this. So we got to get him drunk so he doesn't know what he's doing. And then we'll get him impregnated from him. Or they do that. But they throw in this thing of Avinu Zaken, which if you think about it, is a little bit of a gratuitous insult. Because what's the relevance? What if Father's 40 and not 80? Who cares? If there's nobody to do it, and you got to go for Father. I mean, if that's the right thinking, I mean, Zaken seems to be somewhat of a thrown out line. It's not relevant. So, the answer starts really by looking at the Parshiyot HaMasorah. Is if we look at these as separate stories, and we look at each scene as a self-contained scene, which it's not, because the scenes bleed together in each chapter, then we're going to miss the point. So we look at chapter 18, which is the scene at the tent. ends with Avram's negotiation, and in the middle there's the bridge. We're going to look at the bridge because it's vital. Then we'll say, okay, that's a story about Avraham and Avraham's concern for Sodom, etc. It'll be very nice. Then we have a whole scene in Sodom in which we see Lot and his interaction, and then the Malachim, and etc. And okay, that talks about the destruction of Sodom. But then you got to ask all these questions, starting with, what do I need the whole scene at the tent for? And what am I to make of Avram's negotiations? The whole story starts to become a little bit strange and kind of unraveled. So you got to start by asking the following question, which I mentioned last week, and the truth is, especially in Bereishit, you've always got to ask this question. We have very limited information about the period. We don't know what Yaakov's nickname for Esav was. We don't know what position Esav played on the local football team. We don't know what Avram had for a snack in the afternoon. There's a lot of stuff we don't know. We only know the stuff we need to know. We're told what we need to know, which always then raises the bar and says, whenever we're told information about stuff, why are we told? So some stuff is self-evident why we're told. We're told that Avram had a son named Yitzchak. We need to know that. We're told that he did the Brit Milah, Kasher Tzivah Otolim. We need to know that about the Brit. But there's other things. Do we need to know that Avimelech's family stopped being able to reproduce? Why is that important for us to know? And do we need to know that the name of the town that Lot went to was Tsoar? Why is that? So, at every point, clearly it's something we need to know. We have to figure out why we need to know it. So if we look at this story, which I crammed onto one page, not because I had any illusion, fantasy, that anybody would actually be able to read this, but to show you it's all one story. In both chapters are all one story, and Parshat Masorah. If you look at the back, I broke them up. And you can see that the two chapters, as it were, actually speak to each other in a chiastic form. What's the first scene? And I broke them up, three scenes. What's the first scene? Is at the tent. And the scene at the tent is three guys come to Avraham. By the way, this is Kechom Hayom. This is public. This is in front of everybody. I mean, outdoors. What does Avraham offer to do? Give them food. What does he offer to give them?
Cheeseburger.
Right? What does he offer to give them?
Cow.
Right? He offers to give them lechem. In the meantime, he actually makes them meat. There's meat. There's bread and there's water. Notice.
And butter.
What?
Butter.
Cream, whatever that is, right. But no wine. Okay? He gives them big meal, big delicacy and everything. And then, what do they announce? They announce about the impending birth of Yitzchak from Sarah. And the relationship between Avram and Sarah is a relationship which, from one perspective, is very problematic. Because once already, and then it's going to happen again, Avram has lied about her, and she's been taken into a foreign potentate, etc. But on the other hand, she is somebody who, chiefly because of God's intervention, has remained chaste. Has remained chaste. And she and Avram have a beautiful monogamous relationship. Keep that in mind. Look at the very end, which is the bottom of the left column, the end of Perek Yutet, which is opposite. We also have news about a birth. What's that birth? Ammon and Moab. What's the scene that happens there? There's also three people. Who are the three people? Lot, daughter one, daughter two. But where are they? They're in a dark cave, not out in the open. And what are they serving? The exact opposite. Instead of meat, they're serving wine. Now, given the circumstances, that's what they had. We understand. And they used wine deliberately, and it's kind of echoing the whole story of Ham in the tent, but they're using wine deliberately in order to get father drunk so they can take advantage of him, etc., the way they're doing it. But look at how these stories mirror each other. Here's Avraham serving a beautiful meal publicly to these three strangers, and then there's no news given about an impending birth of a child from this pure relationship of Avraham and Sarah. And on the exact opposite side, you have three people hiding out in the dark, not knowing what's going on, drunk, kind of the opposite of Malachim, and we end up with news of the birth of two mamzerim. two products of incest, Ammon and Moab. Which, by the way, is very critical for us because Ammon and Moab are our closest neighbors. And Ammon and Moab are nations that we have lots of interactions with from the beginning of the period of the Shoftim all the way through David's time and past. Actually, all the way into the period of Malchut Yisrael, through the first Commonwealth. Ammon and Moab are our neighbors, and we interact with them, often at war. Remember, the whole story of David and Bathsheba, which nearly brought Beit David down, all starts with Ammon, where David sends a delegation to console the king of Ammon because his father died. And everything unravels from there. So Ammon and Moab are real important for us. We're not allowed to have them marry in, right? The whole position of Ruth, all of that. And so here we get to the roots of where Ammon and Moab come from, the Ammon and Moab's starting. But look how it's presented is exactly the opposite of where Yitzchak comes from. And so this story is a single story that starts in one place, ends in the same place, but the exact opposite place. Both about birth, three people, there's serving, but opposite kind of stuff. What happens in the middle? After Avraham has his, by the way, important to note, in this weird interaction of Avraham and Sarah and the three Malachim, which remember the Rambam, we've seen this a bunch of times, the Rambam says never happened in real time. It's all a nevuah. Right? And Avram's having a nevuah, he's in bed sleeping, he's visioning the whole thing. It doesn't matter. Either way, what did Sarah say about Avraham? It's in the blue marked thing with the white print. What does she say? Adoni Zaken. My man's an old guy. How's he going to have a kid? Now, that little bit actually became, and it's an important parenthesis, became the focal point of a famous statement in Chazal, which is perhaps the most important statement in Chazal when it comes to Shalom Bayit, which is Mutar l'shanot b'nei Shalom. You're allowed to lie to keep peace. Not only Mutar l'shanot, Ela mitzvah l'shanot b'nei Shalom. How do I see that? Because God lied. Where do we see that God lied? Sarah says, I'm already past my age and Avram's a geezer. And what are the Malachim, that's Hashem's voice, say to Abraham, why is Sarah saying she's too old? And what does he leave out? Right? Shalom Bayit. But notice what Sarah is presented as saying is Adoni Zaken, which exactly mirrors what Lot's daughters say, Avinu Zaken. And it's put in there in order to create this symbiosis, this relationship between the two parshiot where they're speaking to each other, but they're showing exactly how different they are. Now, we stop and ask the question, why do we need this story? So I'm going to start with a larger bit and take a parenthetic note for a minute about something related. When you ever ask the question why you need the story, Rashbam, famous Rashbam, beautiful Rashbam, at the beginning of Bereishit, ask the question why we need the whole story of Bereishit. Everybody asks the question. It's famous Rashi's first question, why do we need the story of Bereishit? The Rashbam comes up with an innovative answer. But we have to step back and be aware of something in order to get the answer. When is Sefer Bereishit being presented? It's not being presented to Avraham. Where is it being presented? At Har Sinai. And Har Sinai, Moshe Rabbeinu is up on Har Sinai, and everybody hears HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Achor, Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho. So the Rashbam says, in order to understand Shabbat, we need the story of creation. Not God created the world in 6 days and therefore we have Shabbat. God gave us Shabbat. In order to understand why God gave us Shabbat and why the prohibitions are what they are, we need the story of Bereishit. That's the necessary background. Which means we need to look at what the Torah says, not from the perspective of its time of the event, but its time of being given. Now, when is the Torah being given? It's being given at Har Sinai. What are we supposed to be doing at Har Sinai? Getting the Torah and then doing what? Straight in to conquer. Which is, we have to look at the stories of Bereishit, which are very much focused on Kibush Haaretz, from that perspective. We're going to go conquer a land. What gives us the right to conquer that land? Why us? So let's see. We go back to the bridge. Avraham, the interaction with the three guys. Then there's a bridge. What happens? These guys go to Sodom and Avraham walks them. A few years ago, we looked at the Rashbam's commentary through this whole piece. Fascinating piece. That Rashbam says, who was Avram talking to when he said 50, 45, 40? He was talking to one of the Malachim. The Malachim are the entire story. Meaning the Malachim come, and then the Malachim walk, and Avram walks them, and the Malachim turn around and say, Avram, am I going to keep from Avram what I'm going to do? Avraham is going to be a great nation. He's going to teach his kids to do Derech Hashem, Lasot Tzedakah Mishpat, in order to bring all these brachot. And Avraham turns to him and says, hey, time out, wait a second. What about Mishpat? How can you destroy Sodom? What, a 50, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10, and then that's it. And then they go into Sodom. That's what the Rashbam says. Talking to the Malach is Nevuah, is the way of the Hashem. Right? Again, it's an innovative approach. But when you walk it through, everything works perfectly according to that approach.
This is a Yehu Stoma.
Uh-huh.
They went to Stoma.
Towards Stoma, and he's walking with them.
The Abraham Odenimo made the tent. He's still standing with Hashem.
Which could mean, because how many were in Abraham's tent?
Three.
And how many go to Stoma?
Two.
So it could be that that's the one. They're still talking to the one. Possible. So what is the bridge part? The bridge part is all about the greatness of Avraham. Please take a look at it. I'll read it. It's difficult. Avraham is escorting them. Am I going to keep from Avraham what I'm going to do? Avraham's my partner here. I got to tell him what I'm going to do. It's going to be a powerful nation. The whole world's going to be blessed through him. I know he's going to teach his kids and his generations to do Derech Hashem. Right? A second. In order to be bringing the schar. You know, this whole thing is about the greatness of Avraham. And then he says, I hear the cries of Sodom. I'm going to go see what's happening. And they go down to Sodom. And then Avraham is standing in front of Hashem. And that's where the negotiations come in. So, this whole piece. Now, look at the parallel piece. Part number two, which is the bridge from leaving Sodom to get away to the cave. Take a look what happens. Avraham gets up in the morning. Wait, what's Avraham doing there? This is Sodom. Avraham gets up in the morning. He goes to that spot where he stands and he looks down and watches the destruction of Sodom. And when Hashem destroys Sodom, he remembers whom? When it comes to the Mabul, it says, Vayizkor Elohim et Noach. And he saves Noach. What does it happen here? What did you expect? Vayizkor Elohim et Lot. That's what you would think. What does it say? Vayizkor Elohim et Avraham. It's Avraham's zchut. And therefore he saves Lot. Avraham's zchut sits in the middle of each set. The middle, the bridge, is all about the greatness of Avraham. Of Avraham teaching Tzedek u'Mishpat. Of Avraham having this great schut that ends up saving his family. That's in the middle. Yeah, Jason. So, what happens then when we talk about Sodom itself? These guys, first of all, Avram's negotiations is Sadiqim. Remember we talked about why he stops at 10. One would also be the claim. What is it that Avraham is imagining about Sodom? Avraham hasn't been to Sodom that we know of. He knows that the people are evidently bad, really bad place. It's deserving sort of a mini Mabul kind of thing, utter destruction. He also knows that Lot's been living there. What does he expect would happen if Lot were living there? Lot having grown up with Avraham. He would expect that Lot would have some sort of an impact. It would be at least a small community of people who would care enough about stuff that Lot would have impacted on. So what does he start with? He says, you know what? I'll bet you there's 50 people in that town that Lot has been makariv and at least are sensitive. They're not guilty of whatever so terrible it's going to destroy Sodom. They're not guilty of that. Parenthetically, what is Sodom? We talked about last week. What is Sodom guilty of? We find out in Yechezkel. The way that they treat the poor. That's what Sodom's guilty of. The way that they mistreat the poor and they're disenfranchised. So that's what Avraham thinks. And now he negotiates down. Why does he stop at 10? Because what is it that we're imagining here? If there's an innocent person in town, a single innocent person in town, what does Mishpat demand? That person should be saved. In other words, there's a town full of wicked people, the town deserves to be destroyed. There's a guy who's innocent. So what's the Mishpat? Pull that guy out of town, destroy the town. What does Avram know from history is the minimum that you need in order to actually save the place?
Over eight,
right? Because how many were there in the Mabul? There are eight on the boat, and they couldn't save the world. They were saved. So Avram stops at 10. Says, evidently, in God's calculus, in order to actually save a place, you need 10. Now, I know this sounds kind of hokey, but if you look at Yechezkel Yudalad, you'll see this exact notion. Yechezkel Yudalad, Yechezkel talks about three great people who were able to only save themselves, but they couldn't save the world around them. Noach, Eov, and Daniel, it depends who he's talking about. Right? But Noach is the example there. He's good enough to be saved, but not good enough to save his place. So what does Avram say? Avram says, look, okay, if I can find 10, then they can save the place. Meaning, the Rishayim will die over there, but the place doesn't have to be destroyed. Less than that, of course, you're going to save the innocent, but you're going to destroy the place. And that's where it goes to. Okay, now, let's see what happens. These two guys come in, and what are they supposed to be doing? They're supposed to be looking for tzaddikim. So instead of going door to door to try to find tzaddikim, what do? They just throw themselves on the mercy of the town. Now, what should happen? And by the way, where are they coming from? Whose tent are they coming from? Avram's. So what should happen here? There should be people fighting, like happens in our shuls, people fighting over who gets to bring them home for dinner. Instead, they're standing out there, nobody's taking them in. Finally, who takes them in? Lot. So we think, okay, we found one good guy. How do we see that we don't even have that? Because what happens next? They're in the house. And what happens? The whole town gangs up on them. It doesn't matter whether we go the conventional way that they wanted to gang rape them or the other way that I suggested last year, which is that they want to interrogate them. Either way, it was brutal. Got the whole town out there doing that. If there were some tzaddikim in town, what should happen? And this, by the way, has impact on the parsha of Shechem. If there was some tzaddikim in town, what should happen? There should be a protest. There should be people stopping them. There people getting in the way of them and saying, you can't behave this way, these are guests. Nobody does. The only one who does is Lot. So we kind of have the feeling that Lot's a good guy. If Lot's a good guy, he'll get saved. We find out Lot's not such a great guy. How do we find that out? Read the end of the story. And the big kasha on Lot is, why did you have wine the second night? That's the big kasha. But now, the last thing I want to point out, because this actually cuts to the whole point of the shir, is what's the warning given to Lot when they leave town? Remember Ephraim Kishon? In a famous book, Don't Look Back, Mrs. Lot. Right? Don't look back. In the meantime, look in the green on the left side. What's Avram doing? Avram's staring at the town. We talked about last week with the smoke. Why is Avram allowed to stare at the town and they're not? Because you don't have a right when you've been spared because of somebody else's schut, because of vitamin P protects you. You don't have a right to look back and look down and watch them be destroyed because you're no better than them. But for the grace of God or for the kinship of Avram, there go I. Avram, on the other hand, is very removed from Sodom. He's not part of this at all. And looking down and watching the destruction, as painful it is the appropriate scene. What's this all about? Because remember, we're about to come into Eretz Yisrael. What gives us the right to conquer Eretz Yisrael and dispossess other people? The moral high road. The moral high road. We are the Avraham who gets to stand up and look and watch. And so therefore, and this entire story is phrased, look at Yitzchak's birth and look at Amon and Moab's birth. Look at these scenes, how opposite they are. And it's all about saying, you're coming into the land. What gives you the rights to the land under the conquest is the moral high road. And what you must maintain to be able to justify it is the moral high road. And if you lose the moral high road, then you are somebody who, if you look back, you turn into salt. You'll be no different. That's, of course, the warning at the end of Achrimot. You'll be just dispossessed like everybody else if you behave that way. So this story which has a lot of bizarre components to it, actually seems to be there not so much to tell us about Lot, but to tell us about Avraham, and about Avraham's zchut, and about Avraham's greatness, and using Lot as sort of the foil against which to see Avraham, and to ultimately justify the conquest of Eretz Yisrael.